Welcome to Blue Dot, a look at our place in space. I'm Dave Schloem. On this program, we continue our series of shows profiling the United States Geological Survey's volcano observatories by visiting with staff scientists from the one that began it all, the Hawaiian Volcano Observatory, located on the Big Island of Hawaii. Home of some of the most active and interesting volcanic vents on the planet, it's a special place with an amazing history and a legacy of training volcanologists from around the world. Our guests are the Hawaiian Volcano Observatory's scientist in charge, Ken Hahn, and staff research geophysicist Ingrid Johansson. They join us now from their offices at the HVO located on the Big Island of Hawaii. Ken and Ingrid, welcome to Blue Dot.
Thank you.
Thank you, Dave. It's a pleasure to be here.
Yeah, welcome to Blue Dot. I'd like to know a little bit first about the history of that volcano observatory, because the Hawaiian Volcano Observatory is the oldest and most venerable of all the USGS volcano observatories. And I was wondering if you could, Ken, maybe just tell us a little bit about how it got started and maybe tell us about the person that founded it.
Sure. The Hawaiian Volcano Observatory was founded by Thomas Jagger, who was a professor at MIT back in 1912. And he was motivated after going and seeing the devastation on Martinique after the Mont Pelee eruptions in the early 1900s that killed like 25,000 people. So he was motivated to study volcanoes and try and find ways that, you know, some of the hazards could be mitigated and how people could live more safely with volcanoes. So he came to Hawaii and established the Volcano Observatory with funding from MIT. And then he also reached out to some of the local businessmen and people here and was able to pull funding together. The USGS was kind of in and out of running the Volcano Observatory in the 20s and 30s. And the National Park was established 4 years after the Volcano Observatory in 1916. And they actually ran the Volcano Observatory in some of the early years, along with the National Weather Service. And it wasn't until the 1940s that USGS took over permanent running of the Volcano Observatory here.
And can you tell us exactly where the observatory is?
Well, the observatory is has been moved a bit. We've been affected by our own volcano. In 2018, when we had the large eruption in Lower Puna, the upper part of the volcano around Kilauea caldera, which is known as Kalua Pele at the summit of Kilauea, our volcano observatory was perched right on the edge there. And it turned out that there were a number of fractured blocks there, and our volcano observatory and the Jagger Museum were both sitting on a block like that. And there were thousands of earthquakes over 3 months, including for a 2 month period where there was a magnitude 5+ earthquake every day. And it destroyed both buildings. So after that, we've been kind of moving around. We went down to the University of Hawaii at Hilo, and then over there's a customs building here at the port. We were in and out of there. And right now we're in temporary housing at a place called the Ironworks building down on the bayfront of Hilo.
So the volcano itself is helping you determine where you can have it.
Yes. And luckily for us, there was a disaster supplemental bill after that and several bills, and our congressional delegation and other members of Congress came through, and we're building a couple of buildings. There's going to be one USGS research facility here in Hilo that we share with other USGS people. And then we'll also have a smaller field station back up in Hawaii Volcanoes National Park, but just a teeny bit further away from the edge this time.
And talk a bit about, and maybe this would be good for you, Ingrid, why is Hawaii just such a perfect place for a volcano observatory like this?
Yeah, Hawaii is really the ideal place for a volcano observatory because Kilauea is so active. You rarely have to wait very long to see more volcanic activity. There's alternately inflation, deflation of the volcano, eruptive periods, gas release periods. So there's just an abundance of phenomena that occur. And as a result, you're able to put together really amazing data sets of all these occurrences.
And Ingrid, could you talk a bit about, give us the tectonic setting for Hawaii? Because it's very different from, like, for example, the Cascades volcanoes, which are caused by subduction off the coast. Same with the Aleutian Islands, Indonesia, places like that. This is one of the most unique places on Earth. Can you talk about, you know, why Hawaii is actually there? Why is that chain of islands there?
Yeah. So unlike the Cascades and the Aleutians, which are part of what we call the Ring of Fire, Hawaii is not part of that ring. It actually occurs very much in the middle of the Pacific tectonic plate. And the reason there's a volcano here is because of an upwelling in the mantle that we call a hotspot. So this hotspot is incredibly long-lived. The same hotspot produced magmas that were erupted at all of the Hawaiian islands. And famously, as the Pacific Plate has moved over this hotspot, it has created the chain of islands. And Kilauea, Mauna Loa are the most recent expressions of that hotspot.
Do you know anything about the story of how that was unraveled, how that was figured out? Because it's so interesting, you know, it's so different from other places. It's similar in a way to Yellowstone. But can you explain to us how you guys determined that over the years?
It's an interesting thing. And the original geologists that came here, and there were some pretty famous geologists that showed up here, Whitman Cross, who was one of them, and a couple others, they looked at the chain of volcanoes that were active. And as you move to the northwest, they became less active and more extinct and eroded. And the original idea is that it was like a whole row of candles that would have been snuffed out one by one, leaving the last one there. That's before we knew how dynamic the Earth was in the like 1800s and early 1900s. J.P. Morgan was the first person to actually come up with the hotspot theory based on Hawaii. We are kind of, if there is a hotspot on the planet, this is the one. It's the biggest of all of the hotspots and the most continuous. And just as plate tectonic theory was coming up, he put together the idea of the hotspot and this idea of the mid-ocean rift spreading and moving the islands over a hotspot. And so that was a key idea that came out of that and let us do this. And then it turns out once you had that idea, the Hawaiian hotspot became the place that they unraveled a mid-ocean ridge spreading, because people came here on land and were able to date all these lava flows that were coming out very frequently, like Ingrid said, from our volcanoes. They were able to get a bunch of dates and put together the key that allowed them to read that magnetic barcode that's encoded onto the seafloor and figure out how much time had passed as the ocean opened up. So it's pretty much a feedback loop of coming up with the idea that this is a hotspot, recognizing it, and then taking the information here and putting that back into the seafloor spreading and plate tectonic model.
And is there a new volcano going to be forming on the ocean floor? Like as the seafloor continues to move, will we get a new Hawaiian island eventually?
Yes. So there was recently a name change. And so the next volcano, you know, in the chain, which used to be termed Lauihi, is now has the name E Kamaʻehu E Kanaloa. And it will still be several thousands of years before that volcano reaches the surface. But we do often see seismic swarms and other type of activity reminding us that it's definitely there.
Wow, that's interesting. And it's also cool, and our listeners can do this. You can go on Google Maps, Google Earth, and you can look at the seafloor and see the Hawaiian Islands and see the chain of seamounts going way up, you know, all the way up to Siberia to kind of track, you know, the Hawaiis of the past.
Yeah, and you know, one thing I guess I'd like to add is this phenomenon of the island sort of getting older and colder as you go down the chain was recognized by Native Hawaiians and worked into the stories of Pele, who is the deity of the volcano here in Hawaii. When she arrived to the Hawaiian Islands, she went looking for hot rocks, and she started in Kauai at the very end of the chain and, you know, was pounding her stick and looking for hot rocks all the way through the chain until she finally got to Kilauea and actually found it. So, you know, this progression down the line was something that's been recognized for a long time.
That's a cool story. I love that. Okay. tell us about the main volcanoes there that you study. You know, I know of Kilauea, that's, you know, the most famous one, and Mauna Loa. What are the main eruptive vents and actual volcanoes?
Yeah, so there are five active volcanoes in the state of Hawaii. Kilauea and Mauna Loa are the two that have erupted within the past century. Hualalai and Mauna Kea are both on the Big Island of Hawaii. Those are also termed active, as is the volcano Haleakala on Maui. So, you know, as I said, in the last century, Kilauea and Mauna Loa have been the two most active volcanoes. Both of those have very well-developed rift systems, which mean that the eruptive vents have occurred at locations, sometimes on the flanks of the volcanoes and sometimes at the summit. In particular, from 1983 until 2018, the persistent vent at Kilauea was at a location called Pu'uo'o. And this was on the East Rift, some tens of kilometers away from the summit, and produced regular lava flows into the ocean. But that changed in 2018 when the collapse of Pu'uo'o sent a large intrusion of magma down into Lower Puna, which eventually erupted underneath the subdivision called Leilani Estates. We had eruption there for about 3 months, also, you know, down this rift zone, and then that very quickly, you know, shut off. So after the 2018 eruption, we predominantly had eruptions up at the summit of Kilauea. So we've had overall a total of, I believe, 9 eruptions in the last 4 years, most of those at the summit. And then just in the past year, we had an eruption off the southwest rift zone of Kilauea and another in the Middle East rift zone, which was the first time since 2018 that eruptions have ventured outside the summit.
It's also interesting to me to consider, you know, the Big Island of Hawaii. You know, if you go from the bottom of the seafloor to the very summit of the island, it's really the biggest mountain on Earth, isn't it?
Yes, that's right. It's at least as big as Everest if you go from the seafloor to the top of Mauna Loa.
And much bigger volume-wise.
Yes. And, you know, even on land, it's nothing to shrug at. So Mauna Loa reaches up to 14,000 feet above sea level. It's really very high, but it can fool you because the slopes are so gentle. It looks like a hill, but it's 14,000 feet high.
Yeah, and of course, big is a definition here, right? But there's about, from the deepest part off Mauna Loa to the summit, it's close to 30,000 feet of relief there. But of course, its total elevation is well below Everest. And its mass, it's hard to pull Everest out as a single mountain out of a mountain range, right? But the mass of Mauna Loa is really astounding. It also not only goes down to the seafloor, but it's bent the seafloor under it. So you're really looking, you know, at something on the order of 45,000 feet of lava piled up to make the summit of Mauna Loa.
Wow.
So it's really big. And if you, our volume estimates suggest that if you unwound all the lava in Mauna Loa, you would make a stack of lava that you could go around the equator a kilometer wide and a kilometer tall, like 3,000 feet wide and 3,000 feet tall, go around the equator 1 to 1.5 times. So if you're thinking of building your own island in the middle of the Pacific, prepare to haul a lot of stuff out here to put in the ocean to be able to build an island like this. It's pretty amazing.
Yeah, that's impressive. And how long in terms of geologic time did it take for that, for the mountain to build from the seafloor to the heights that it's at now at 14,000 feet?
You know, we don't have a perfectly good age because the oldest rocks are down in the middle there and we can't get to them. But our estimates are somewhere around 750,000 to 1.5 million years to build something like Mauna Loa.
That's really not very long.
No, it's pretty fast. Yeah.
Yeah. And, that's amazing.
And if you think all the way to Kauai, Kauai is about 5 million years old. So if you think of the five main Hawaiian islands out that direction, that 5 million years is equivalent to all of the prehistory of humanoid species. So, you know, we kind of track that in the time that it took to build the Hawaiian Islands.
We're going to take a short break, but stay with us. When we return, we'll continue our conversation with Ken Hahn and Ingrid Johansson from the United States Geological Survey's Hawaiian Volcano Observatory. I'm Dave Schloem, and you are listening to Blue Dot. And we're back, and thanks for listening to Blue Dot. Let's return now to our conversation with Ken Hahn, scientist in charge for the USGS Hawaiian Volcano Observatory, and staff geophysicist Ingrid Johansson, as we look at the history of the observatory and the amazing volcanoes that it studies. I know for the USGS, you like to track hazards, and I'd like to know, like, you have a threat potential with color coding for different volcanoes all over the place. What are the main threat potential volcanoes? Well, give us an overview of that.
The threat potential for just Hawaii or for...
For Hawaii, for the... Yes.
Yeah. So we're a little different than the threats that are for the rest of U.S. volcanoes that are the subduction volcanoes. A lot of their threats are... explosive eruptions, ashfall, and then lahars, which are mud flows. If it rains on the ash, you know, or the ash gets mixed with water some way going down drainages. And so here, the principal threat at the moment is lava flows. But we also know the behavior of Kilauea is at times when there are significant large eruptions down the rift zone that can drain the main magma bodies, that we do get explosive eruptions where magma mixes with groundwater, and we can have pretty good explosive eruptions with ash that would make this island a very different place than it is today.
Well, let's get into the eruption types a little bit more in detail. Tell us about what the types of eruptions are there in Hawaii, because they are very different from, for example, from what we saw at Mount St. Helens in 1980. The types of eruptions in Hawaii are very different from what you find in those subduction zone volcanoes like the Aleutians and like the Cascades?
Well, we have our own kind of eruption named Hawaiian eruptions.
Hawaiian type.
So
it's got a brand name.
So it's the principal kind that we have here. And they usually start off as magma moves up to the surface, it comes out of a crack that we call a fissure, and we get fissure eruptions that tend to be, you know, from a few hundred meters to, you know, they can be several tens of kilometers long. Those eruptions typically send material up in the air, somewhere around, you know, 50 to 200 feet or something like that. And our material, the lava, is very fluid here. And that's because there's a lot more heat at the hotspot, and we're melting a higher percentage of the mantle. So when it comes up, we're melting a lot of mantle. It comes up into a shallow magma chamber, and it doesn't stay there very long. So it stays very hot, very fluid. So when it comes out, it makes these very fluid lava flows that run down the slopes. And then hence, as Ingrid was talking about, the very low slopes of our volcanoes.
And there's a couple of terms that I just love about your lava types you find in Hawaiian-type volcanoes. Here in the continental U.S. too, we have the same kinds of formations. Tell us about, because I love these names, A'a and Pahoehoe.
Okay. You know, these are names that Native Hawaiians used for the lava, right? And Native Hawaiians, as Ingrid was saying, were very aware of their natural surroundings and extremely good geologists. And they had to be because this was their primary resource, right? So there's several different potential origins for these names, but I can give you the ones that I've been told that I kind of like the best, where Pahoehoe, the hoihoi is kind of, if you imagine paddling a canoe, the swirling water behind it, it's the swirling texture on the surface of the lava. And a'a lava is thought to be in when, if you look up at a hill at night when there's an A'a flow, there's many little points of glow coming out of the flow front where you can see kind of the molten interior, and they're like little eyes. And this is kind of what the Native Hawaiians were trying to get at, that you could see this particular kind of flow. So one of the really interesting things is they name these things after active processes. And Hawaiians were really great at inferring how things formed. And so that also makes it a little hard to go through some of the great literature that they have compiled, you know, over time about the islands, because you don't know when they really saw something and when they have inferred something, because they were excellent at being able to understand how something formed.
Pahoehoe and A'a, those words are now part of the scientific vocabulary. So no matter where you go on the earth, the ropey, swirly lava is pahoehoe, and the sharp, clinky lava is A'a.
Yeah, I used to take students on field trips to study some of those lava flows here. And I was just told them, you know, that smooth, ropey formation you see that's easy to walk on, that's the pahoehoe. And the stuff that would be, if you were barefoot walking over that jaggedy stuff over there, you'd be going, ah, ah, ah. So remember, ah.
Right, that's, yes.
That's kind of the bus driver explanation of it, yeah.
It worked for eighth graders.
Yeah.
Okay, let's talk a bit about the eruption history that's gone, because there's been so many interesting eruptions throughout the history since the volcano's been there and since the observatory's been there. Can you kind of go through some of the main eruptions through time, some of the highlights, the greatest hits, as it were?
Yeah, so, you know, in Native Hawaiian legend, there's quite a few eruptions that are recorded, and so these have been worked on by scientists and Native Hawaiians together to pull some of the early eruptions, particularly the explosive eruptions that happened between the 1500s and around 1800. And so these are encoded in some of the Hawaiian legends, and they're actually pretty well described, including the impacts of, you know, talking about how the midday turned to night and rocks fell from the sky and lightning bolts were flashing and things like that. These are not things that you could make up if you hadn't seen one of these explosive eruptions. So that period from 1500 to 1800 was when we think Kilauea caldera formed early on in that, in the early 1500s. And after that, there were repeated explosions. And the summit in there was kind of a place, a kapu place, was forbidden place to be, right? Because it was dangerous to be up there. The first people that came here, you know, from Europe, the first Europeans traveled with Native Hawaiians who told them some of these stories as they walked around. And by that time, Kilauea caldera had collapsed and the inside was more like today. And most in the 1800s, the descriptions were kind of similar to what we're seeing today, lava flow activity inside of deeper craters within Kilauea caldera or Kalua Pele. In 1924, the first really kind of big significant event happened that was really monitored. That was after Jagger had set up the volcano observatory. And they detected a number of earthquakes down on the southeast end of the island. And then the lava lake that was in the crater drained out and disappeared. And presumably that magma moved down into that area in the kind of the southeast corner where we had the 2018 eruption, but it didn't erupt down there, unlike in 2018. So it might have erupted offshore. We really don't know. We didn't have, you know, there were very few instruments at that time. But the summit collapsed in a much narrower fashion than what we saw in 2018. This was then followed within a couple of weeks by a number of big explosive eruptions that threw out blocks that were enormous, like they're blocks that weighed 5-10 tons or something like that were thrown out of Halemaumau and around in the area, along with a lot of ash that was mostly pulverized rock. The volcano became relatively quiet. There were a few minor summit eruptions after that until the 1950s, when again lava, we had a big eruption down in the southeast corner of the island in Puna, right where the location of the 2018 eruption was, followed by the 1959 summit eruption, which was the first episodic fountaining eruption that was seen So that's similar to what we're seeing in the current eruption right now, is that there's large fountains from the vent, and then it goes quiet for a few days, it recharges, and then there's another set of fountains. So these are in very much episodes, exactly what we're seeing right now. Only those fountains, they produce the highest fountains ever recorded on Kilauea, up to 1,900 feet tall. And then about a month after that eruption stopped, we ended up with more lava flows down in Puna, down in the southeast corner of the island again. After that, we went through a whole series of kind of alternating summit eruptions and eruptions in the rift zones, mostly in the upper and the middle east rift zone, but a little bit in the southwest rift zone, going back and forth, until we had another episodic fountain eruption that started in the Middle East Rift Zone at a place that built called Mauna'ulu. And that was in 1969 to 1974. So that was the first prolonged eruption that was recorded by scientists here in Hawaii. There are others that are encoded in Hawaiian stories and legends, of course, but this is the first one that was actually really had detailed observations with it, and had 12 high fountain episodes, followed by a continuous outpouring that built what we call a shield volcano. 1975 brought a major magnitude 7.7 earthquake, and volcanic activity seems to have kind of quieted down. And we think that a lot of the magma was being intruded into the rift zones. And I'll let Ingrid talk about that later, what the mechanics of that are. And so we didn't see much until the start, really, of the Pu'o'o eruption. There were a few minor things, but in 1983, we start the Pu'o'o eruption, and we go into that 38-year-long eruption that Ingrid was talking about earlier.
And what's going on there, like, right now? What's it been like the last few weeks? We're recording this at the end of February 2025.
Yeah, so starting on December 23rd of last year, we had our 8th eruption at Kilauea, our 9th. Overall, if you count a 2022 eruption from Mauna Loa. And this has been a very episodic eruption. It's been alternating between phases of high fountaining and then a complete pause. And then, you know, we see pressure build up a little bit more, and then we go to another stage of high fountaining. So it's actually been a very exciting eruption for that reason. There's always something new happening.
And Ingrid, you study literally the shape of the earth and the shape of the landscape.
Yeah.
And that's really interesting to me. Could you talk a bit about how you use that as a tool to understand what's going on with the mountain and help do, you know, predicting what's happening with the mountain's eruptions?
Yeah, sure. So as magma moves into a magma chamber, It blows it up a little bit like a balloon. And in fact, the volcano itself will start to bulge. And this is what we refer to as inflation. The whole volcano will start to sort of move up and outwards a little bit. And so by using surveying methods, and in particular these days, we use survey grade GPS. And we also use a satellite-based technique called INSAR. We can measure these very small centimeter level changes in the shape of the volcano and then infer how much magma had to come in order to cause that level of ground inflation. So with these methods, we can then sort of monitor the volcano as the pressure inside the magma chamber is increasing. And over the last sort of year or so, there has been a very sort of consistent pressure level at Kilauea. And so we've been in this phase where we've been able to use these tools to observe when we're back at a pressure level where an eruption is likely. And that's also happening now with the episodes in this current eruption on a slightly different scale. The pressure in the magma chamber is accumulating in a way that's very consistent and allows us to make some sort of a forecast for when we might be back to a pre-eruptive pressure level.
And then what are some of the other tools you use to monitor the volcano? For example, seismicity. Tell us about the sensors that you have to literally, listen to the vibrations coming from the mountain.
Yeah. So volcanology is a truly interdisciplinary science. So we use seismometers, we use gas sensors, we also use cameras and webcams to collect data, as well as just to have images of what's going on. Seismometers around the island pick up a number of phenomena. So for sure, they pick up the earthquakes that are associated with changes in stress at the volcano, and in particular, putting a lot of magma into the magma chamber, and you know, so much that the volcano bulges also puts a lot of stress on the surrounding rocks. So you get a lot of earthquakes in that way. They also record phenomena called VLPs, very long period earthquakes, which are associated with fluid motion, as well as very high frequency noise almost, which we call volcanic tremor, which is often associated with fountaining and active eruptions. So there's a whole variety of fingerprints that can show up in a seismic record that will tell us, you know, different types of things that are happening at the volcano.
And could you talk a little bit more about the gases coming out of the volcano, how you monitor that, and what some of the signatures are you're looking for to let you know something's changing?
Sure. I'll take a stab, and then Ken might want to jump in. But yeah, so we have two gas geochemists on staff who monitor gas released from our volcanoes. The primary gas that we monitor is sulfur dioxide. And this is gas that's exsolved from the magma when it is very, very shallow. So typically not until we're just about to have an eruption do we see any type of significant SO2 release. However, there's a lot of really useful information in that. In particular, the amount of SO2 is proportional to the volume of lava being erupted. So it's one way to come back at, you know, what are the erupted volumes. Another way in which the gases are monitored on a different time scale. So as magma is coming up from a deeper magma chamber, it can start to release CO2. So in between eruptions, our gas geochemists are monitoring the distribution of CO2 release for some sense of how things are coming up from even deeper in the volcano than the magma chambers we see eruptions from. Ken?
Yeah, and I'd like to just say when we do measure things on the volcano, there's two kinds of primary measurements that we do. Some are continuous, like seismicity, or a lot of the deformation signals are continuous or nearly continuous. Cameras now are pretty continuous. But things like gas and a few other things, they're discontinuous. We can't take them as often as we want. So our volume of gas measurements require sunlight, because we use a ratio of a couple of different peaks in the spectrum to look at. And these are in the ultraviolet spectrum. And so we have to have the sun out, and we're looking through the gas and looking at blue sky. And that's how we actually get the volume, along with wind velocities and things. So we can't always take that. You have to have the right, all the stars have to align to get good gas measurements. Plus, people have to run out in the field and do it. We can't do it by remote instrumentation at this point. So it's a place where, you know, it's probably the next great place to advance in volcanology, is to figure out how to automate some of these things. And if there's ever any way that people can figure out how to do it at night, that would really be a big difference maker, because changes in the volume of gas are definitely correlated, as Ingrid said, into changes in either the eruptive dynamics or material coming into the magma chambers. And this is particularly true if we look at the arc volcanoes that, you know, are found along the Cascades Range and into Alaska. Those oftentimes release gas prior to their eruption, and those are important signals of how the volcano is getting ready to erupt. Our volcano doesn't do that as much. Mostly we see the gas during the eruption. And as Ingrid said, it helps us understand the flux, or what we call a fusion rate, how that changes during the course of an eruption.
We're going to take a short break, but stay with us. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation with scientists Ken Hahn and Ingrid Johansson from the United States Geological Survey's Hawaiian Volcano Observatory. I'm Dave Shlom, and you are listening to Blue Dot. And we're back, and thanks for listening. Let's continue now with our visit with Ken Hahn, scientist in charge for the USGS Hawaiian Volcano Observatory, along with staff geophysicist Ingrid Johansson. An interesting aspect of the Volcano Observatory and just Hawaii in general, I know, for like example, geology and volcanology students from all over the world go on field trips there to go check it out. My daughter was on one years ago and got to see lava flows into the ocean, and it was quite spectacular. Could you talk a bit about how important your facility is for training, you know, the next generation of volcanologists?
Yeah, so because of the long history of very active volcanism here, this is the place to get experience responding to eruptions. So many of the volcanologists at the observatories in the Cascades in Alaska started out by either interning or volunteering with the Hawaiian Volcano Observatory. And many of our own staff members, in fact, started out as interns and volunteers. Yeah, this is one of the few places where you can very reliably get an experience with active response and an experience actually interacting with lava and some of those skills that become really important when you are responding to an eruption, even in another location.
You want to add anything to that, Ken?
Sure. That's a great summary that Ingrid gave about how important this is, you know, to developing scientists. I also spent about 20 years here at the local university teaching. And I can tell you there's no more incredible way to make just the average person understand that the term solid earth is meaningless. There really is no such thing. And it's something that geologists are all trained to know. But I can tell you, even when I first came here, I had read a paper by Don Swanson, who is a very famous volcanologist here, about Pahoehoe lava. And I read the paper and I thought, well, that's kind of interesting, but it's a little bit muddled and everything. And then I came out here and spent 3 months looking at Pahoehoe lava, and my opinion turned to like, that's one of the best papers I've ever read, you know, and you can't understand how dynamic the earth is as a place until you see it being dynamic. So this is one of the few places where geologic time crosses human time and allows us to see the earth change before your eyes, right? So being out on the lava flows and seeing lava flows, it's just an incredible thing. And the National Park Service, I will just say, along with Native Hawaiians or Hawaiians here, that they've really built a culture and an experience here where you come in here and it's a place to be treated as reverent, you know. So it allows you to come in and really feel the kind of how amazing it is to see this process going on. In some other places in the world, you kind of get in and sometimes it turns into more of a party atmosphere when people are watching volcanoes. But here, I really think it strikes something deep in most human beings to see this, how the Earth was created, because this is really the processes that started 4 billion years ago on our planet to construct continents. And it's still going on here today, right? And so it is really a great experience for non-scientists and scientists alike to be able to understand how much the Earth actually does change.
Could you talk a bit more about the Hawaii Volcanoes National Park and the relationship you have with them? Because the way you just put that is quite beautiful. It really is one of America's treasures, as well as, you know, a place of scientific research that you do. It's also just a magnificent place.
It's a really incredible place. And I was fortunate, my first tour of duty here, or however you want to call it, the first time I came to the Hawaiian Volcano Observatory was in 1987. And I was fortunate enough back at that point, there was still a Park Service residency. And so you could live inside the national park, and all the rangers lived in there. And so the USGS Volcano Observatory staff, a lot of us were living in the park with the park rangers, and you developed this real camaraderie, which was a great experience. Park Service people are just amazing. But this park is a national treasure. There's no question about it. And it's a treasure for a couple of reasons. One of them took a little while for me to understand, but you know, it's clearly a geological national park, at first and foremost, with active volcanoes. But it also is the last reservoir of native Hawaiian forest, too. So they're kind of the caretakers of the forest. Both Pele and Hiiaka are kind of represented here. And they work very closely with the Hawaiian community. They have advisory council. There's a number of native Hawaiian park rangers and things to really develop that understanding, that deeper understanding of the place and how it's all interconnected.
There are hazards associated with volcanic eruptions. And even though Hawaii is not like an explosive type volcano like you would find in the Cascades with something like Mount St. Helens or Mount Vesuvius that destroyed Pompeii. But can you talk about the actual hazards that you have to watch out for there?
Well, it's one of the things that it takes a while to understand and be able to read one of these lava flow fields out here and be able to see what's safe and what isn't. Because the first thing you have are places where the ground is unstable or might be underlain by molten lava or something like that. And, you know, when you first come out here, all the rocks look black. And after you've been here for a while, you can see that there's actually many different types of lava beyond Pohoihoi and A'a. And each one of those tells a story about how they're formed or how they're forming. And so we learn to read those surfaces of lava, to walk on them and to be know where we're safe and things. But some of the more particularly dangerous places are up near vents where, you know, the intensity of the venting, wind direction, things like that can shift and cause a lot of trouble. And those things, people can get in trouble fast if they're not prepared for that. There's an awful lot of gas. And unless you're equipped to be in the gas plume, you can get caught out, and then it not only makes it difficult to breathe, but you can't see in the heavy sulfur dioxide plumes as well. So, and most of these vent areas are around steep cliffs and holes in the ground and things like that. So, you know, just wandering around out on the lava fields without understanding them, it can be particularly hazardous. And as an example, where your daughter got to see lava going into the ocean, we didn't really understand that when I first came here in the 80s. But as we watched the lava go into the ocean, we had, you know, 30 years of watching lava go into the ocean during the Pu'o'o eruptions. And what we found out is that what was going on, and lava can't just flow across water because it's heavier than that. So what happens is, as it goes into the ocean, it breaks into sand. That sand makes a beach, so it adds a layer to the beach. The lava flows across that, covers it up, makes another beach out in front of it, and it's building these things that we call deltas, and those build out on the steep side of the island, but it's a big, steep sand pile underwater, and it's not solid rock. It looks like solid rock on the top because that's what the cap is, but the sand pile gets too big and gets unstable. All the sand slides out, then the rock snaps off, and there's big explosions, and you know, we've lost as much as 20, 30, 40 acres of lava into the ocean in one single episode, with big blocks being thrown, you know, hundreds of yards inland and things like that. So that's a very dangerous situation there. And that's where most people in the last few decades have been injured, is associated with those collapses of these lava deltas out there.
So in addition to volcanic hazards, Hawaii has a pretty significant seismic hazard. And part of that, you know, is not just the earthquakes that go along with the run-up to an eruption, but we have a number of large faults that can produce big earthquakes, magnitude 7, possibly even magnitude 8 earthquakes. So one of the things that we monitor is the motion of these faults. And, you know, any sign that we might be approaching a very large earthquake. And that's perhaps an unexpected hazard for people here because we're not near a plate boundary. You might not expect that we would have such large faults. But as a result of, you know, the weight of the volcanic pile bending the oceanic crust. You know, we have a plane of weakness between the oceanic crust and the volcanic pile that facilitates sliding of that pile and can produce these very large earthquakes.
Yeah, I hadn't quite thought about that, although I have seen the big earthquakes they've had there.
Yeah.
It's interesting. And also, all those earthquakes, you know, they let you know that you're literally on a living part of the earth.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And then I will get in big trouble if I don't add this in. I realize what Ingrid was saying about important things that we missed there. But one of the other big hazards that affects a broader part of the community are volcanic gases that are emitted during the eruptions. And so while these are not life-threatening, the volcanic gases mix downwind and oxidize, and they form a kind of volcanic smog that's referred to here as fog. And they affect the downwind parts of the island, and they can impact the entire island chain. This air layer can go all the way up into Oahu, and it can cause a lot of breathing trouble and things like that. And nearer the volcano, of course, the plume has Pele's hair, which are the strands of volcanic glass, and small particles of glass. It's very unsafe to breathe that in near the volcano as well. So that's a kind of a wider ranging impact that we get here that a lot of times people don't really think about.
And Ken, could you talk a bit about the role that the USGS plays there in providing for public safety to give people hazard alerts?
Yeah, that's one of our primary roles here, is one, to publish information, to inform people about the hazards, and then to let them know, you know. The island of Hawaii is like everywhere else. Most of the time people are going about their business and, you know, aren't concerned about the volcanoes, and we don't want them to be. We want them to pay attention when we think something that is going to happen that might impact them. So in addition to our hazard education, we have an alert level scheme, and we publish about our volcanoes either daily, weekly, or monthly, depending on the state they're in. Like right now, Kilauea, since it's actively erupting, we're publishing about it every day. So to keep people up on what's going on with it. It's not impacting communities, but it still is impacting the park a lot with tourism. And at times it's definitely impacted the air quality around the park of the communities that are immediately adjacent to it. But we have a color code and a word system that we use. So there are green or normal state volcanoes. There are volcanoes that are what we put in the yellow state, which is advisory, which is, you know, have the potential to erupt. And then we have orange, which is watch, which is either the volcano is getting very near an eruption, or there's a lower stage of eruption going on. Like right now, it's not threatening communities. That's what the state we're in right now is, an orange watch for Kilauea, because it's not having a direct impact on the surrounding communities. And then there's finally, we have a red or warning state when there's a volcano that has a potential danger to surrounding communities. And so during the run-up to the Mauna Loa eruption, that's something that we did. We went out a couple months before we thought the volcano was going to erupt, and we went to all the communities that could potentially be impacted by a volcanic eruption from Mauna Loa and explained what was likely to happen. And Ingrid was instrumental in looking at conditions in mid-September to early October of that year. Things changed, and Ingrid and our seismologist, Jefferson Chang, both came up independently with things that concerned them and made it look like Mauna Loa was going to erupt a couple months before it did.
And can you tell us about that, Ingrid?
Sure. So we had about 10 years of unrest at Mauna Loa before the eventual eruption. And during that time, it was clear that magma was moving into a dike-like body, which is a vertical crack that was filling with magma. And so I constructed a model that used our network of GPS stations around the volcano to estimate where in this crack most of that opening and that magma accumulation was happening. So in September, October of 2022, we started to see that the locations of opening were starting to move more shallow in the volcano. And this coincided with an uptick in seismicity that persisted. So we've seen upticks in seismicity that then calmed down again, but this one really kept going. So those two observations together really suggested that magma was moving a lot shallower in the volcano and really getting poised to erupt.
Well, Ken and Ingrid from the Hawaiian Volcano Observatory, thanks for sharing your expertise and passion for studying this just incredible place on planet Earth.
All right. Thank you. It was fun to talk to you.
Thanks a lot, Dave. Anytime.
Thanks again to our guests from the United States Geological Survey's Hawaiian Volcano Observatory, scientist in charge Ken Hahn and geophysicist Ingrid Johansson. You can learn more about their work at usgs.gov/observatories/HVO. Blue Dot is a production of North State Public Radio, a service of CAP Radio in beautiful and talented Northern California. We're distributed by PRX. If you want to revisit, share, or check out past episodes, you can do just that on our website, mynspr.org. And while you're at it, subscribe to our podcast so you never miss an episode on our website, the NPR One app, or wherever you get your podcast groove on. Our theme music, Big Wave Dave, is by Matt Schiltz. Blue Dot is engineered and produced by the maestro, Matt Fidler. For all of us here, I remind you there that from deep space, we all live on a pale blue dot.